Welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer, and it's a big time of year for travel books. So we are going to concentrate on two of the newest of them on this podcast. I'm not talking about Frommer's Guides. I'm talking about a travel memoir and a beautiful new book from National Geographic. So let's get started. I think it says a lot about over-tourism that there is now not an article, but a complete book on the destinations that you should go to replace the places that are being overloved. It is called Here, Not There, 100 Unexpected Travel Destinations, and I have its author, Andrew Nelson, on the phone. Hey, Andrew, many congratulations on this wonderful book.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me on your show. It's a famous one, so I feel quite honored, Pauline, to be on a Frommer show.
Well, I appreciate that, and I'm honored to have an author from Nat Geo on, because you guys are the gold standard when it comes to beautiful coffee table books that are filled with actionable advice. So what was the impetus for creating this book?
Well, it started during the pandemic, this idea, and then it really took off when, you know, I think collectively Americans and the entire world had a huge case of FOMO when the pandemic ended. So fear of missing out.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, the places, these iconic places that we love, became really, really crowded. I remember waiting for 2.5 hours to get inside the Pantheon in Rome. And now I think you need reservations, but These were places that were just so overcrowded. It's Smoky Mountains, you wait for hours just to get inside the park, and then it's hard to get reservations. And then again, secondly, inflation. Once you manage to get to where you were going or get inside where you wanted to be and things you wanted to see, the prices were higher thanks to inflation. So all of a sudden for families, Myrtle Beach became Monaco, and it was costly. And third, as you pointed out, Pauline, all of us in National Geographic are concerned about over-tourism and its environmental impact. So I thought if I could just redirect all of us to less visited places that contain some of the attributes of the more crowded ones, both the planet and travelers could both win.
Right. Although, you know, it's funny, I was just in Naples in March, and I thought by doing that, I would be going to a here, not there place. But Naples was jammed with visitors, and one of the museums I wanted to see, actually, it was a funerary chapel with wacky sculptures. It was sold out for the whole week that I was there.
Yeah. And that's such a disappointment, because how often, Pauline, are you going to be in Naples? And this is what you wanted to see. I think anybody who has been to Pompeii knows what happens when the cruise ship buses pull up. So, that's something. So and that's actually a good example. The Roman Forum, for example, is mobbed. So what I tell people to do is to go to the suburban train station and buy a ticket to a town called Ostia Antica. It's this, basically, you can take the Milk Run train through the Roman suburbs towards the sea. And what you'll find when you get out is a sort of do-it-yourself Pompeii. It is the ruins, and very well preserved ruins they are, the port for ancient Rome. So just quickly, ancient Rome wasn't on the ocean. It was actually on the Tiber. So somebody had to get all that grain and foodstuff and supplies and lions for the arena in somewhere. So it was Ostia, which had at its height a population of about 60,000 people. Huh? And then the river silted up and the shoreline changed. So the entire city was abandoned. It wasn't ever reused. It just fell into ruin. So these ruins are really well preserved. And there are baths, and there's actually an early version of shopping mall with the mosaics telling people what was sold in the booth in front of them. You can explore all of this. You can climb upstairs, which you can't do in Pompeii. You can, duck down corridors, and you can even go into the bath, and the kids love this. There is a communal toilet in there, and they all love getting the pictures taken sitting there. So, again,
on the ancient toilet. Yeah.
And so again, it's a way of getting up close and personal with ancient Rome that, and don't get me wrong, Pompeii's great. All of these iconic places are great, and we hope that you go to them. But these are places that are usually less crowded,
or
less known. And so fabulous, a fabulous place.
And sometimes it's less that the place is, I don't want to say it's less that the place is iconic, but sometimes you can have the exact same experience in a place where it's going to be less crowded. For example, with safaris.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, often you are more likely to see other safari vans in places like Kenya and Tanzania and South Africa than you are to see the animals. Or you might be viewing the animals in a circle of these vans, and it feels more like a zoo than like being on safari. And so you guys are recommending, and I was looking at trying to find it. Where do you need to go?
Gorongosa?
Yeah. What? Tell us about that experience.
Well, Gorongosa is actually a happy experience in Africa and African conservation. There aren't really too many of those. It was a national park in Mozambique. And Mozambique fought a vicious, vicious civil war. I think you might remember that. But what happened was the warriors on both sides of this fight, of course, had machine guns and all the modern armaments, you would think. And they shot all of the wild animals for food and for sport. So that was in the 1990s. So something like 90% of the large mammals were missing. They were extinct. So it was completely devastated. Empty of animals. And then what happened was conservationists got together and they slowly reintroduced these species. A lot of them came from South Africa, from Angola, to now there are just a lot. The elephant are back. The leopards are back. And it's hard to get to.
Right. So maybe more expensive than.
And I got to give a shout out to the telecom entrepreneur who donated like $100 million, or he pledged $100 million to do this. It's George Carr, who is an American. But it started with, sort of keystone species. So we're seeing what's happening all over the world, which I think is really heartening. And you've heard of rewilding, yes?
Sure.
Yeah. So again, this was one of the first experiments with that. So. If you go, you are going to, it's a little rough and hard to get to. You have to go from Joburg and then, take progressively tinier flights to get there. But the experience is what it used to be like before mass tourism hit the Serengeti.
Right. I mean, the photos in the book are just spectacular.
Yeah,
it makes you want to go.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is, and I shout out to our design team because how they pick these photos is always magic to me because, when you work closely, and when I was in, a staffer on Traveler, you always, were just sort of blown away by these, and you don't realize the art of picking just the right photo to go with the words. Yeah. It's a real art. So kind of lost in these days of social influencers on Instagram, but
yeah. Oh, well. Yeah. Yeah, sometimes those photos are more about the person in the bikini than they are about the destination.
Yeah, or the watch that they were paid to show off or something like that.
Yeah.
But no, this is I'm hoping, Pauline, that people use this book as thought starters, as something inspiring them to travel different.
Sure.
Travel,
well,
become an explorer.
We've been talking about far-flung destinations for our American audience, and that's mostly who listens to this podcast. What are some places to go in the U.S.? And I got to say, you got an eye roll from me when you suggested going to Cleveland rather than New York City. I wonder if anybody even in Cleveland would suggest that. But why Cleveland over New York City? And then give me some others that I think are more plausible.
Okay, so you are a doubter about Cleveland.
I'm a diehard New York City lover, and I live in New York City. So
Okay. Well, you live in New York, Pauline. I understand that. But what's so interesting is that for live theater, Cleveland is the second largest collection of live theater in the United States.
After New York.
Right. Absolutely. So.
Well, after New York. Although maybe if you're just going for a vacation, that doesn't matter because you only have a couple of days anyway.
Yes. It's all around Playhouse Square. So there's a collection of, I believe, 8 theaters. Don't quote me on that, but there are enough there that they're always doing Broadway musicals. They're doing experimental theater. And I don't, what's the average cost now for a Broadway show?
Well, actually, because there's a glut of shows opening, and that has led to costs going down. So we're seeing prices for as little as, $69 a pop, which isn't too bad. But, you know, you could pay as much as $300. It really depends.
Yeah. So, I mean, you could see several shows for $300 in Cleveland. So it's also got this gritty, fun environment. So if you can imagine walking around, imagine a wooden Brooklyn, right? And then turning the corner and seeing these incredible onion-domed Eastern Orthodox churches because, for example, Cleveland has one of the largest Ukrainian populations in the country, has the largest Slovenian population. So they were very excited when Melania Trump became First Lady. It also has we've heard of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, correct?
Sure.
And Lake Erie is cleaned up. You can go swimming there. The Cleveland Museum of Art, it's not the Met, but it ain't no small potatoes either. Huh. So again, it's important to stress, I'm not saying that don't go to New York, don't go to Broadway.
Right.
Everybody is going to eventually go there, and we do there, and we hope you will. But consider these places too. Become an explorer.
Right.
Paul, I'd love to show you Cleveland. Maybe we can go one day. You can come, come with your New York, sell me attitude. I'll see if we can. I think Clevelanders are kind of like New Yorkers. They're tough audience.
They're proud of their town. So you also go into the fact that sadly many of the nature areas in the United States are being overloved. You go to Great Smoky Mountains National Park, and you're going to spend hours just getting in the gate because of traffic jams there. So what are some of the nature destinations that people should be going to instead of the more famous ones?
Well, you know, one of the ones that I talk about, so you've been to Cape Cod because you're in New York. I would imagine you've been to Cape Cod. Well, one of the alternative to Cape Cod, I suggest, is Sleeping Bear Dunes National Lakeshore, which is located on the northern part of the Lower Peninsula in Michigan on the Lake Michigan side, so on the west. And it's a collection of beaches and sand dunes that have the same sort of beachy, away from it all feel. It's not the Atlantic Ocean, but it has that same, you can get lost walking along the lake there. And the water color is just wild. It's Caribbean blue. It surprised me.
Like,
I mean, it's gorgeous. And it even has its own province town in the form of Traverse City, Michigan, which is this funky, diverse community at the foot of the Leelanau Peninsula, which has is fast becoming a great wine growing region. They're
absolutely
known for their
great restaurants there too.
Yeah. Oh, so you've been there.
Oh, I've been to, I know Northern Michigan very well. It's a wonderful part of the country to visit. Absolutely.
I grew up in Detroit. So yeah, but I had never really been in Traverse City. So I really enjoyed it, nor in Sleeping Bear Dunes. Again, these are the places that, you know, perhaps people from Detroit and Chicago might know a little bit, but the rest of the country doesn't really know about them at all.
Right. Okay. So I know this is like asking what your favorite child is, Do you have a favorite place in the book that you hope everybody will go to? And, you know, that's really a very apt and wonderful go here, not there destination.
Well, you know, I have a couple. Because as you know, in the travel business, when people say, what's your favorite place? You always have to say it, define that, because are you talking big city, national park? But I will tell you a place in the States that I think is really special and not too many have ever been there is Natchez, Mississippi. Huh. Natchez is located halfway up the state on the Mississippi River on a series of bluffs overlooking the Mississippi, which afford an amazing, amazing view of the entire river stretching out for miles. And and you can see across to Louisiana. In the 1850s, it was said there were more millionaires in Natchez than in per capita than in New York. Because, of course, the legacy of cotton, which meant also slavery. But what happened was a bunch of Northerners came to Mississippi to seek their fortune and struck it rich and built these amazing, amazingly beautiful antebellum homes, of which they have a huge collection still. The city was never burned during the Civil War because so many Northerners lived there. They cut a deal with the general not to burn the town down. They're always thinking about business. And what's happened is that you can tour these old homes in what's known as the spring and fall pilgrimage, where they're open up and you can tour them. But what I find really interesting is that Natchez is now talking about other narratives, the African-American experience of what it was like. So there are now tours that you can take that give you the perspective of African-Americans and what slavery was really like. There are monuments now to the civil rights protests. So Natchez is really confronting and dealing with some issues they never did before.
Right.
And it's great to see them open up and to do that. And against the backdrop of very few tourists. So you really feel like you are, you know, finding an unexplored place. And I'll tell you, the people there are just great.
You've sold me. That just sounds wonderful. So it's been so delightful speaking with you. Thank you so much, Andrew, for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
Okay, Pauline, great. Thank you for having me.
Angie Orth has been a travel blogger since 2006. You may know her as Angie Away. And now she has a really thought-provoking, fun new memoir. It's called Flirting with Disaster: True Tales of Fear, Failure, and Faith. Hey, Angie, welcome to the Frommer Travel Show.
Hi, Pauline. Thank you so much for having me. This is very exciting.
Well, it's exciting for me. This seems to be the year of travel memoirs. I think a lot of folks during the pandemic, that's what they did when they couldn't travel. And yet yours is very different because, as you say in the title, it also has to do with your faith. And that faith informs your travels in such an interesting way. Fairly early on in the book, you talk about the concept of lust in wanderlust, because obviously lust is one of the big sins. How does it figure with wanderlust, or does it?
I think it depends on the individual's journey. I think it absolutely can take over in a way that lust could take over your life, or envy or greed or any kind of negative thing could take over your intentions maybe and inform your decisions and just take over kind of what you do. I think, you know, people who are prone to overwork, sometimes that can be due to greed or due to a perceived lack or never having enough. And it can all spiral out of control. So I think lust is one of those things. It's in a fireplace, a fire is really great. Outside of the fireplace, not so great. So everything can be helpful, but or God-given or great or useful, but it's not always if things spin out of control or take on a life of their own. So I think lust often, especially in my upbringing and sort of the evangelical Southern church, lust and wanderlust were kind of the same thing, because wanderlust, why would you need to go anywhere besides here? Why would you need to look anywhere else for your contentment when you can't you just find it here? Can't you just be happy here? And so there was a real negative lens put on somebody who wanted to go travel and do and see and experience. So
yeah. Well, everybody in your life. I mean, you start the book with everybody's fears for you. Everybody is nervous that you have taken off as a single woman at the age of 29, which is a time, you know, in your background, maybe you should have been married by then. And you actually talk at one point in the book, I'm going to grab my notes, about the Proverbs 5 woman.
Yes.
Tell me about her.
So in the world I grew up in, we heard a lot about the Proverbs 31 woman, and that's in the Old Testament. It's the last book of Proverbs. And the way it was pitched to me as a kid was very much, she does this and she does this, and she's good at cooking and she's good at sewing and she's the ultimate homemaker and everybody loves her and she's so wonderful. And she just gives herself to everyone else and has no time for herself. And it's so noble. And then there was sort of this other shadowy Proverbs woman, the Proverbs 5 woman. And that was the one who was out carousing in the streets and gallivanting and wanderlusting and doing all these things that a real good, godly woman would never do. And so I had a very black and white view of what a woman was supposed to be as a woman of faith, a Christian woman. And so it really took me a lot of time to grow out of that and realize that these are not specific people. These are, you know, the Proverbs 31 is a poem that was written in Hebrew. And it's not a prescriptive, like, this is what a woman has to do thing at all. It's more about character. And it was about honoring the women and the work they did at that time. And so, which was mostly in the home. And it was about honoring women getting ready for the Sabbath and stuff like that. Meanwhile, 2000 years later, we're like, oh yeah, I have to sew and cook. I'm not going to sew and cook. At this point, I lived in New York. When was I going to sew or cook? I didn't have time for that. You know, I was working, which is also valued with the Proverbs 31 woman. So there was always this dichotomy of you have to be this one and you definitely can't be that one. And the Proverbs 5 one was the one who traveled and right. strayed and yes. was outside of her own home and her own little protected bubble.
Yeah. And so with all of that as kind of the basis or what's going on under your journeying, it makes it even more remarkable that at the age of 29, you just quit your job and decided to travel for a complete year. People in your family were worried about that, but did you learn to be a different type of woman? Did you make the journey psychically as well as physically, do you think?
I think so. I think I have learned so much more in studying in the years since that's happened, and just that year in general, about how much value there is in the differences that we've been created with. And all women are not designed to do the exact same thing just because they're women. Same with men. Like, God didn't design any of us that way. And there's literally a whole like guidebook about it, the Bible, which has all these women of faith in there, and they don't all do the same thing. And they're valued and they're part of the story. So there's got to be more room than just sort of the little box they stick us in sometimes.
Right. Absolutely. And I don't want to make your book sound too heavy, because there's a lot of joy in it and there's a lot of horsing around. You go to Laos for New Year's. I had no idea. It's one big water fight that goes on for days, right?
It's so much fun. That was one of the most fun weeks I ever had. Everybody gets water guns. Everybody is just soaking wet, just dumping buckets on you, ice, and everybody's just partying in the streets. And I think Lao in particular is a very conservative, quiet, reserved kind of society. And they really let loose. Like, this is their fun couple of days. It's their New Year's. It's washing everything clean and starting over. And it was so beautiful. I loved it.
And you also went to Greece. You went to a bar where everybody gets smashed. What, tell us about that bar. That was insane.
That one really, really blew my mind, not to put too fine a point on it, but you get, I forget what the place is called, but you get a shot.
It's called the Smashing Bar.
Something to that effect. And you yeah. get a shot, and this one particular shot, the bartender decides what to hit you in the head with afterwards. So you take a shot, well, you put on a helmet, you take the shot, and then the bartender either hits you with like a milk crate, a baseball bat, a sledgehammer. And everybody's just thinking this is the greatest thing in the world. I'm like, even in my 20s, I was not interested in getting right. hit in the head with a baseball bat. No, thank you. But it, I mean, it is a, it's, I think it's still open to this day and people flock to it. It's very yeah. popular.
No, that was crazy. And then this may sound crazy, but it had never even occurred to me that somebody of the Christian faith would get pushback from their family and from a pastor for doing a yoga retreat. So tell us about the yoga retreat and why that was disturbing to the people in your life.
I don't know that I realized until I was going to do it, because I'd been doing yoga in New York for years, just on and off. I was no guru. I wasn't that into it. It was just a thing I did for fun, for relaxation. And when I decided to go to this yoga retreat in Bali, there was some uproar from back home. And in researching it, I said, I'll look into it. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Like, what do you mean yoga is not okay and against our faith? And so I really dug into it. And boy, there are some strong opinions. And, sure. you know, I think what I discovered is you get what you come for. So if you're using it as exercise or a way to like calm yourself and your breath and you're praying and you're doing your own faith in that, then I think that worked out fine for me. For some other folks who were seeking spiritual encounters with maybe darker forces, that didn't work out great for them. So it's, I had no idea. There's definitely something to it. I think anytime you're messing around in the spiritual realm, that you never know what you're gonna get into, because there is a spiritual realm and
right.
we don't understand it. So yeah, really interesting. And still I'm getting comments that are like, how could you possibly do yoga if you're a Christian? So
well, and also, I mean, in the course of this yoga retreat, you were taken to a temple. And I think you say in the book something to the effect of, you know, there are all these things you're not supposed to do. Praying to false idols always seemed like a really easy thing to avoid.
Yeah.
Until suddenly you were in this situation where it became your faith versus having a travel experience.
Yeah. Yeah. And I did have to decide pretty, I had to draw that line and say, you know, it's not just a travel experience for me. It's something that's antithetical to my faith. And so I'm just going to skip this part. And I even got pushback on that from some of the folks on the retreat who right. were like, ugh, get over it. You're not being sensitive to the culture. And I am being sensitive. I'm not saying anything's wrong. I go do it. I'll take pictures for you while you do the thing. But
because people were being baptized during this yeah. ceremony, but it was a Hindu ceremony, I'm assuming.
Yeah. It was a purification ritual where you dunk into the fountains X amount of times and you're in the water. I think it's closed now because of like flesh eating bacteria or something.
Oh,
something
gosh.
Not awesome. Yeah. 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 Wow. It's a very, very, very old fountain and a place that people have come for years, but you know, tourists go there to kind of get their spiritual vibe on. And it just was, I've already been baptized, you know, I'm good in my beliefs. And so I don't need other ones. But that's okay if everybody else wanted to. And I definitely got some pushback.
Yeah, no, it was very interesting how you dealt with that. And I don't want to give everything away, but there is some dramatic things that happen
yeah.
after that ceremony that are really, really unexpected for those who did take part in it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
It was really one of the scarier moments of the whole trip.
You also had, I don't want to say the luck, but you were in many places at the times when world-changing events were going on. You were in Christchurch, New Zealand, between earthquakes. Yeah. There had been a slight earthquake that was making people nervous, and then the whole city was destroyed after you were there. You were also in Egypt after Arab Spring. Tell our listeners, what was that like?
That was a different way of seeing Egypt. I'd never been before, obviously, but I chose to go with a group tour on that, just because it was after the Arab Spring. I mean, a few months after, not sure. long. And they were still running tours. And I thought this was on my agenda for this year. I'm going to do it. And I'm glad I went with a group. I think like you said, I wouldn't call it luck, but there was nobody at the pyramids. There were almost no tourists there. It was probably the least tourists that have ever been there, probably until the pandemic. Uh-huh. And it was just, you know, people were on edge, but people were still friendly.
But you also had, well, you know, I've been to Egypt not for many years, and I remember the touts as being extremely aggressive, even when tourism was at its height. So I would think, with so little business, the people who are in the travel business, you said it got a little too much.
Yeah, I mean, there were a couple times where I was getting grabbed and pulled into shops, and you know, I chalked it up to people are just trying to make a buck, and maybe there's a cultural difference here about how you interact with customers and how to actually make a buck. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't been back since. I would really like to go back and see how it is a decade later. But it was interesting. You know, the Tahrir Square and the buildings were burned out from the protests, and nothing had happened for several months. It had been real quiet, and they had an interim government in place. And I got there, and within hours, there was a huge massacre. So, and I missed it by not a lot of time, really by hours. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Really fascinating stuff. And there's romance in the book. I don't want to give that away. Yeah. And all kinds of other adventures. To finish up, what do you hope people will get out of the book? What are you hoping to tell people with this book?
So many things, but I think probably the main one is just, you don't have to fit in the box that they put you in. Whatever culture you come from, whatever religious tradition, or your gender, even just something as simple as that, like there's room for all kinds. And I think, you know, my faith tells me that God made us all with our unique makeup, our unique interests, our talents. And I don't think we should waste our talents just because there's a box that we're supposed to fit in. My talents would be very wasted if I was just sitting around sewing and like housekeeping all day. That wouldn't have put me in the position to travel the world, meet a ton of people, make friends that have lasted forever, and tell stories and make people laugh. And I hope that people, even who aren't of any religious tradition, can appreciate it for the travel story that it is. And, you know, it's, yes, I'm a person of faith, but I'm a traveler of faith, and we travel too.
Yes, absolutely. Well, as I said, I think in an email to you today, I thought that was what was most unique about your book. You don't often hear about people of faith traveling and about the interaction between that mindset and those, I don't want to say rules, but you talk about the rules, and you know, a little bit. And so to me, that was absolutely fascinating, and it's a heartwarming book. So many congratulations. Thank you so much for appearing on the Frommer Travel Show.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been a joy.
And that is it for this week's show. I just wanted to alert you that we've had some really interesting articles up on frommers.com that I suggest you take a look at. There's big changes coming to Times Square. That's one of them. As well, King Charles is throwing open Balmoral Castle in Scotland to the general public for the first time. So if you're a royal watcher, or if you're just interested in the decision-making process that went into this, our Brit expert Jason Cochran wrote a terrific article on that. We also have some really good advice on cruising, how to get the best prices and how to get the reservations that you want when you want them if you choose an ocean-going vacation. All right, that's it for me for this week. As always, I thank you so much for listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage.
Imagine cave.